Hey, it's Lisa Z from RCP. In today's episode, we talk to our old friend Jim Fitzgerald about his TV series Manhunt Unabomber, which is based on his experience in the hunt to catch Ted Kaczynski. This is the same session where Laura's internet went out and we had a lot of problems connecting people. So the best we could do in the situation was have Laura and Jim call in on their cell phones and record from there. So the sound quality is not what we would hope for, but we know you will enjoy this conversation with Jim C., Fitz, Laura, and myself discussing Manhunt Unabomber.
It's iconic. The most famous police sketch in history is the Unabomber.
Terrorist called Unabomber is planning to blow up an airliner sometime during the next 6 days.
He's targeting airlines, scientists, computers, forestry people.
We have done every kind of victimology. His victims are totally random.
He's smart, extremely precise. He feels underappreciated, victimized, and he's angry. You figure out the philosophy, you can figure out the man, you can crack the code.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, former New York City prosecutor, retired FBI profiler, and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds, as well as co-creator of Discovery's Manhunt Unabomber. And with me today from London is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard, and founder and director of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for Criminal Minds, where Jim Clemente is my colleague.
And today... again, a very special guest. That's our, I think, our most common guest person on this show, and that is...
Jim Fitzgerald. Do I get frequent podcast miles out of this, Jim?
I think you do. My buddy from the FBI, we went through the FBI Academy together. We worked in the New York City division of the FBI together and then became profilers together and finished out our careers there together. So we have a lot of experience working together, and now we're working together in Hollywood, aren't we, Jim?
We are, and you are a notable character in my third book, A Journey to the Center of the Mind, the first 10 FBI years. So all of Jim's fans out there, if you want to read a little bit more about him before he gets around to writing it, check out my third book, and Jim's laid out throughout it in different capacities and different investigations that we've worked.
Great. I can't wait to read about that.
And we're gonna just for the listeners to distinguish, we will call you Fitz and we will call me Jim so that we don't have the issue of the Jims.
So I call you Jay Clem. Maybe I'll just call you Jay Fitz. That's how I roll.
Okay. That'll work. All right. So Fitz, How has your life changed in the last month?
Well, not a whole lot of rest. The media, between media interviews, you know, live, in person, obviously podcast in studio, and certainly traveling to red carpet events in New York City, as well as L.A. right before the premiere of Manhunt on August 1st. It's really been a whirlwind of a month for me, a little over a month actually, but all positive. And the ratings and reviews for Manhunt are absolutely stellar, and I'm really happy to have played a role, first of all, in the initial investigation back in '95 and '96, and then Jim, you and I got together just about 10 years ago. We formulated some ideas, and lo and behold, it hit the airwaves. On August 1st, and it's still hard to believe. I'm still pinching myself, but here we are, and it's been a great ride.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. And the fact that we were able to, conceive of the idea way back then, before, right around the time you retired from the FBI in 2007, and then to see it actually having been acted out on the screen is pretty amazing. One thing that really brought it home was the other day when they depicted Sam Worthington sitting at his desk, at his pod on the task force, and it had a little nameplate, J. Fitzgerald, on the side of it. And I was like, wow, I remember, knocking on your door and walking into your offices all those times and working together right beside you for many years. And to see that you are now getting, nationally prominent and internationally prominent recognition for the work you did, I just you know, I'm really proud of you, Jim.
Well, thank you. And I do want to emphasize early on, and you and I have talked about this before, but it truly was a team effort by the FBI to bring down the Unabomber. The series doesn't always show it exactly that way. That's what they call literary license or artistic license. But I was very, very proud to be a part of the Unabom Task Force, UTF for short. And we actually did work together pretty well as a team. And the end result, of course, was taking this serial bomber, identifying him, arresting him, and putting him behind bars for the rest of his life. But the part the series is really getting, you know, very accurately covered is it was language that brought this guy down. And that was my role in the Unabom Task Force. And I'm glad they're portraying, you know, that part of it accurately on the series.
Yeah. Well, there's also somebody else in your life that's being portrayed in the series. You want to talk to us about that?
You mean Ted Kaczynski?
I wasn't referring to Ted, actually. I was referring to somebody who taught you linguistics.
Yes. Her name in the show is Natalie Rogers, because she is sort of a composite character, and she's linked, yes, to my partner, Natalie Schilling, who is a now full professor, just promoted recently, at Georgetown University in the linguistics department. So it's interesting how Hollywood takes people in one part of your life and sort of morphs them into another. There actually was a real linguist I met for about 2 hours in July of 95 at his home in Georgetown, you know, the Washington, D.C. Area of Georgetown. And we spent about 2 hours talking about the manifesto. He had been given a copy a couple of weeks before, but it hadn't been published yet. And we went over the facts in it and, you know, the demographic, personality issues that he could pick up just looking at the written word. And I was amazed at this guy and what he really what I learned from him in those 2 hours. His name's Roger Shai. So he was originally going to be in the series, the writer and the director. And I know you and I talked back early in the day with mm-hmm. Tony Gittleson. And when this thing finally came to pass with Discovery, they were going to have Kevin Spacey play this guy, Roger Shai, in sort of a cameo role. Because as you mm-hmm. know, Kevin Spacey is one of the exec producers of Manhunt. But they met the real Natalie, found out she really did do a postdoc at Stanford in like 97, 98, a little bit after the Unabom case. They said, you know what, we're going to instead get rid of the Kevin Spacey character and bring in a Natalie character. But we did give her the last name of Rogers. So it's a little shout out to this guy, Roger Shai. Roger, his last name is Shuy. So that's where her last name comes in. A few times it's used on this set. But Natalie traveled with me. The real Natalie traveled with me to Atlanta. She actually helped them write up the blackboard or the whiteboard, whatever you're using in a few scenes, with some linguistic factors on it. So it really worked out well in that regard. So Natalie was actually a sort of a consultant to the series also, the real Natalie Schilling.
That's awesome.
And I think that's really important. One of the things I really admire about this series is how clean it is and how it's so, with such ease, goes back and forth through time and tells this story in kind of a bifurcated narrative. And I think that's it. Not only it keeps it for people who know the end of the story, you know, who the Unabomber was and are already spoiled by that. It's just very interesting to watch all these relationships and how they play out. And I think it is important that sometimes you do contract or tesseract certain characters into one character. I mean, that just helps the storytelling along so that you focus on the things that you should focus on and don't get too, you know, distracted. But and it makes the casting just really dense and wonderful. I mean, Lynn Collins plays Natalie, and she's been a favorite actress of mine for a long time. And it's great to see her, you know, do her stuff in this role instead of it being like just a small, you know, role in the periphery. So it's nice to give these actors something really juicy to chew on. I'm sure that you had to do that with other characters in the cast, I would imagine.
Yeah, and it's funny that you mentioned that, Lisa, because one of the issues that we had to deal with, Jim and I and Tony Gittleson, when we actually started sitting down and writing this script, was the fact that there's so much time that passes over the 17-year investigation, so many different bombings, so many different people in and out of this case and investigation. And Jim Fitz, you came in late in the investigation, but actually turned the tide of the investigation, which was an amazing thing. However, to tell that story and to keep that character fresh and bring him in early, we realized very early on that we were going to have to fracture time and go back and forth and do things in a way that may not be linear or traditional. And I think that that's one of the things that Discovery got right with Manhunt Unabomber.
I was just going to say, Fitz, it's been quite a year, actually, rather than just the month for you. But I just wondered, how did it feel seeing yourself on screen?
Well, that's a good question, Laura. And the first time I actually experienced that was actually on the set in Atlanta back in May of this year when they were still shooting. And there's Sam, the next room over. I'm sitting with the director, and we're all in our separate chairs with our headphones on. I'm watching a little TV screen, but I can actually hear Sam and other, you know, actors with whom he's speaking. And it's and he's actually saying words that I had given the writer, and Jim, even you in earlier stages of this whole process, that I actually said back in 95 and 96. And you guys liked them. Andrew Sadrowski, the head writer eventually for the show, they wound up morphing those words exactly into Sam's, you know, dialogue. And I said, I've heard that before. Oh, that's right. I said it 21 years ago. And, it was just a very surrealistic, experience to hear those types of, scenes play out, watch those scenes play out. So then, of course, I saw the 2-hour, premiere at the Lincoln Center up in New York City. Wow. And I watched, you know, that scene and, of course, everything that led up to it and afterwards. And it was truly amazing watching a character being called with my name, you know, Fitz. And, yeah, that's been me all my life. And here's now someone playing me on certainly the big screen at the Lincoln Center, I guess the small screen at everybody's home. But either way, it's just a very special feeling that not too many people that go through this world probably have this opportunity. Maybe it happens after they're dead. But in this case, I'm still very much alive and vibrant and watching at least part of my life and most of it accurate play out before this audience. So it's quite special.
And how about the rest of your family? Because obviously, you know, we've talked about Natalie, but your sons are shown as well. I mean, how does it feel and play out for them seeing themselves on screen?
Yeah, well, it's been a big summer for them, too. One went off to the National Guard. He's in basic training now. It's my youngest, and my second son just had his first baby. But all of them have been watching. I actually watched the 2-hour premiere at home with the real Natalie and the real Ryan, my youngest son. And that was fun. That was a special experience. And he's watching, you know, a kind of a small toddler on the screen being held by his mother, Ellie. They called her Ellie, but her real name was Eileen. But and he said, oh, that's supposed to be me. I said, it doesn't look like me. I said, well, it doesn't really work in Hollywood that way. But and he was half kidding when he said that, of course. But yeah, they're appreciating it. And they're also reading that chapter in my book. So they kind of know, you know, from sort of a more linear sense what was happening back then. And to me, to the case, to Kaczynski, to some of his victims. So but on the whole, they're appreciating it, too. They're enjoying it. And they're like everyone else, waiting for Tuesday nights at 10 o'clock to see the next episode.
I was going to say that our listeners have sent us a bunch of questions, and they have loved watching the series. And many of the questions have to do with what's real and what's not real, and how does it really work in the FBI and all that stuff. And I have copious notes on every single episode that I'm not going to get into all of them. But do you have any sort of broad brushstrokes about things that may not have happened but needed to happen for dramatic purposes? I know there's been some talk about, did you ever really meet face-to-face with Ted? And was that something that was like a tense thing that was on your plate to do? Or can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. And the best way I've come to sort of explain this miniseries and how it's being portrayed and how the facts are being portrayed, or even composite facts, or there's a macro story being told and there's a micro story being told. And the macro story, they are pretty much right on the money in terms of the factual elements to the case. If there are dates, if there are time frames, if there are victims, if there are explosions, if something the FBI did, you know, maybe some of the bosses in certain time frames with Janet Reno, with Director Louis Free, these are all things that happen. So that's the macro story. For example, this past week's episode, they showed the surveillance of the newsstand in San Francisco. That was the only one in the San Francisco Bay Area that sold the Washington Post. Well, that happened exactly as they showed it there. The only difference is there were actually two newspaper stores, if you will, news stores in San Francisco at the time. But that's a minor issue. They just made it one for the production sake. And I thought they covered that pretty well in terms of agents and surveillance people from all over the U.S. came in, and they were following people, whoever bought the that particular edition of the Washington Post with the manifesto in it. As far as Kaczynski, no FBI agent interviewed Ted Kaczynski. And I've been saying this from day one. It's in my book. When he was first arrested, he was sort of cordial, polite. He wanted a chocolate peanut butter bar of some sort that someone went out and got him as they were holding him before his arraignment. But they even asked him, Ted, look, for everyone's sake here, are there any booby traps in your cabin, any trip wires, anything like that that's going to kill people? He just looked at them, smiled, and wouldn't answer. He wouldn't talk to his defense attorneys at first, we found out, nor his court-appointed psychologists and psychiatrists. So he didn't want to talk to anybody. When I first read the script where they put Ted and me in the same room, Ted and the Fitz character in the same room, I was a bit dismayed, and I went back and forth with them about this. And sort of the compromise we reached was I was supposed to interview Ted Kaczynski in 2007, 10 years after his conviction. I was in Colorado. Right. I was going to go to his prison, interview him, and lo and behold, it fell through at the last minute. I had about 50 questions I wrote down, and that's what the writer borrowed from.
Well, and here's the thing, right? You were actually scheduled to, you're flying out there, and you were scheduled to interview him, and you got a message that morning, didn't you, saying something really bizarre?
Well, yeah, and for your viewers' edification, just so they know, in the Supermax in Florence, Colorado, you are in a single cell by yourself 23 hours a day, 7 days a week, basically for eternity until you die. And you come out 1 hour a day to work out, take a shower, whatever, you're back in your cell. So I knew this, of course. This was all set up months in advance, and I'm about 30 miles away, give or take, driving down the interstate to Florence. And I get a phone call on my cell phone from the correctional officer who handles Ted Kaczynski saying, oh, I know we had this interview planned, but Mr. Kaczynski wanted me to tell you that, sorry, Fitz, but he's busy today. He can't talk to you. So how busy are you in a cell 23 hours a day for the rest of your life?
So you can at least say that you and Ted Kaczynski did communicate with each other, although he wasn't very forthcoming with that communication.
Well, and the only other communication I had with Ted, and this did happen in real life, and I drew it out over about five pages in my most recent book, is on the day he was sentenced in the Sacramento courtroom, I was in there sitting diagonally behind him, and he knew who I was because my name is all over the affidavit to get the search warrant, and basically it was based on his language to get us into his cabin, and the judge signed off on it. But here 2 years later, I'm in the courtroom, and he's just sentenced to two life sentences. He's gone forever. And he's sitting in his chair as the judge left, and somebody yells across the room, hey, Fitz. And he knew right away, Fitzgerald, he's a pretty bright guy. He turns around, looks at me, and he gave me about a 45-second stare. Mm-hmm. Like Jim, Laura, and Lisa, I've never been stared at by anybody.
Wow.
If looks could kill, or if looks could bomb, they certainly would have happened in that courtroom today. And finally, the marshal stood him up, put cuffs on him. He just looked away. I just stared right back at him. I didn't smirk.
That's right.
I didn't blink my eye or be cocky with him or anything. But I kind of nodded my head a little bit like, well, I know who you are. Now you know who I am. And maybe we'll meet again someday, Ted. But so far, that hasn't happened.
Agent Fitzgerald, I am so glad to make your acquaintance at last.
Fitz, they kind of portray you as sort of like the rogue profiler against the quarry, obviously, Kaczynski. How much do you think you do share in common?
With Kaczynski?
Yeah. I mean, that's the kind of, they're trying to almost play the two of you off as if you are, you share things in common and you're both kind of doing, I guess you're portrayed as sort of the introverted and stubborn kind of rogue profiler trying to bring in this, forensic linguistic profiling, and he's out there super intelligent doing his thing, pitted against each other. Do you think you did share anything or do share anything in common?
I've kind of been asked that before, and I certainly realize the miniseries is attempting to juxtapose the two of us in that regard. I think that's more literary license than anything. I mean, I'm a social person. I don't think Kaczynski could do an interview like this, certainly not with three different people on the line or even in person, and certainly not with women. He had a whole thing about women. He could just never figure them out. Luckily, I more or less figured that out in life. We are certainly different in that way. He's a loner. He didn't want to be anywhere near society. I certainly had no problem with that. But, you know, I won't even pretend to compare with him and his IQ somewhere in the 160s. But I think we could say that, you know, I'm a half decent, intelligent guy, and I'm interested in reading and learning. And, you know, a lot of people read his manifesto back in the day before we knew who the Unabomber was, and they were just turned off. This is nonsense. This is stupid. But there were parts of it that I felt myself agreeing with him. And again, up front here, nothing about bombings or killing people. But there are, like, even a broken clock is right twice a day. I mean, there are a number of tenets and dogmatic issues he would discuss that, you know, maybe we are a little too much involved in technology, and maybe it does control us a little too much. And who knew 20 years later we'd all be sitting around a table somewhere, you know, eating dinner, and half of us are doing something on a cell phone, which, you know, that's probably part of the argument he was making. So I agree with him in some of those regards, but I think from a personality perspective and certainly a family perspective, family is very important to me. My friends and colleagues are very important to me. That was something he never really could deal with or wanted to deal with. And I think if there's any big delineation between our two personalities, that's where that would come.
Well, sure. And he was certainly not the first person to ever have those kind of theories about technology and warnings about technology. And he wasn't the first, and he certainly wasn't the last. So it's not, I don't think it's any big deal that people would agree with those basic tenets. But, and to a certain extent, do you have to become obsessed with him and really get to know his thought processes in order to catch him? I mean, is that kind of part of it, and understanding his worldview in order to pursue him and ultimately catch him?
Yeah, and that's really what I focused on during the time frame, you know, from July of 95 through April of 96 when he was arrested, but just trying to look not only at what he wrote, because we were given a real prize with any serial offender. And Jim knows this. He's arrested his share of serial offenders, as I have. And you rarely have that glimpse inside their soul or inside their mind in terms of how they're thinking. And here's a guy that put, you know, 35,000 words out there in his manifesto alone. And, you know, there were 13 letters before that, some of them rather lengthy. So we really had insight into this person, because as I learned as a fledgling linguist, and I officially became one years later when I went to Georgetown and got my second master's degree in linguistics. And I realized that, you know, language does tell a lot about you, how you speak it, how you write it, you know, even what you read, what language, you know, what's the language you're reading? And I don't mean English, German, or French, but I mean, what kind of books are you reading? Oscar Wilde is known as saying, you know, you are what you read. And there was nothing that thrilled me more than walking inside his cabin 3 days after his arrest. And this is like April 6th of 96. And there's are his books all lined up. And I just said, I need a list of these books. This is so fascinating. And there was about 220 of them that he saved over all these years. Mm-hmm. So it's not just using that language and which tells you what a person is all about, but where does that language originate? What is the origin and the provenance of it? And of course he borrows from other ideas, other books, and, I was interested in the novelist that, and I actually put this list on my website. Anybody interested, jamesrfitzgerald.com. One of the bonus chapters for my book 3 is the list of the 200 books found in the Unabomber's cabin. And I kind of put it in a question form, you know, how many of the Unabomber's books have you read? You know, what does this tell you about you? And his favorite novelist was a British novelist, of course, a very famous one, Charles Nick Dickens. He had 3 books of his, and he had some books. He was interested in twin studies for some reason. These were either articles or books about, like, twins separated at birth. He had a few different articles about them, and, you know, why would that have fascinated him? You know, who knows?
It's probably an issue of nature-nurture. He was pretty smart, and he probably aimed that intellect at himself and realized that he was pretty damn screwed up. I mean, we know a number of things about him from his own writings that were never published. And we know that he went through a lot of psychological issues, right?
He absolutely did. And while on the subject, I mean, he had a brother, David, 7 years younger than him. And, you know, they weren't twins, obviously. But David grew up relatively, you know, normal, quote unquote, you know, married and lives a decent life. And probably the biggest thing that made him anywhere near abnormal in adult life was the fact that his brother was the Unabomber and he had to turn him in. But so there, I'm sure Ted knew, hey, if his own brother can live with a woman and, you know, marry her and all that. He was very upset, of course, when David first got married to his wife because, you know, he felt that man shouldn't give up his freedom and autonomy and all that stuff, which was really the theme of the whole manifesto. Ted was definitely looking. I think he was looking at a lot of these books and even the Dickens novels, Hard Times and Oliver Twist. They're about, you know, loner type people and isolated people who are growing up in a society sort of alien to them. So, you know, it's not surprising that would be some of the books he would and some of the stories he'd want to learn about, maybe to help better understand himself.
Well, I remember you, Fitz. I mean, when I came over to the FBI, and I remember spending a lot of time with you when I was in the behavioral unit, and we talked about this case a lot, and of course it's in your books. But I really am excited to, I've certainly read all of the reviews that have been published about Manhunt, and I look at all the Twitter feeds as well, and it seems to be getting, you know, incredible reviews and publicity. So I just want to congratulate you. You're one of my dear friends, and you deserve the success. And, you know, I'm sure it feels amazing as you have had such an incredible response to it. So I just want to say, you know, congratulations. And obviously Clemente was part of that, and also Tony Gittleson, who was also one of the writers. And, you know, it sounds like you've done a great job, and I can't wait to see it.
Well, thank you, Laura. And yeah, it was a team effort, as I said earlier, to make the identification and arrest itself of the Unabomber. And it was definitely a team effort to put this miniseries together. And again, as you guys know, and I'm sure your viewers know, it's not a documentary. It's not meant to break down, you know, factually, you know, day by day, a diary sort of effect of what was happening in the Unabomber case and who was doing what. It's a part fictitious story told of a very hard worked investigation by hundreds of FBI agents over 17 years and other law enforcement agencies too. And to see it come to the screen and over 8 hours be able to tell this story and the complexities involved. And I can't tell you guys how many times I would still hear people, oh, yeah, the Unabomber case. Yeah, well, the brother turned him in, right?
Yeah.
And these are seasoned investigators sometimes. I said, well, did you ever work like a serial bank robber or serial rapist case? Well, yeah. So if somebody calls up and says, hey, Joe Smith robbed that bank, your job is easy, right? You go out and pick the guy up and your case is over. Well, no, I'd have to build my case and put it all together. Well, of course, and that's what we did in the Unabomber case.
Right. It was incredibly difficult. You created an entire new way of putting together a federal case against a serial killer bomber that had never been done in the history of man. So, I mean, it was groundbreaking. It was unbelievable. It just changed the way law enforcement, it gave law enforcement an amazing new tool. And to try to say, oh, his brother turned him in, so that was it, is just ridiculous. Because at the same time, the brother turned him in because you were able to convince the Department of Justice to have the Washington Post actually publish it, and because you knew that somebody would recognize his writing and his ideology, and that's what actually solved the case. So many times we use media strategies to get people in the public to help us, and that this was just a massive, the biggest media strategy ever employed by the FBI in a federal investigation. So I just don't think people are being realistic when they think that just the fact that David Kaczynski actually made the call because his wife did recognize.
That's what I was going to ask you. Is it true that it was the wife first to recognize?
Yeah, sure. So actually, it was David's wife, Linda, who read the manifesto on the internet at FBI.gov. So it was the first time the FBI's website and the internet was actually used to solve a serial killer bomber case. So it was this case was different and groundbreaking in so many different ways. And you were the center of that. There's no question about it, because without the tool of forensic linguistics, which before you didn't really exist at all and certainly was never applied to a case like this, without that tool, this case would not have been solved. more people would have died.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, Jim. And it was almost by default that it happened, because I was, my law enforcement career pretty much matches that of the Unabombers. I was about 15, 17 years into my law enforcement career when I got sent to the UTF. And I have all this investigative background from 11 years as a police officer, 7 years in New York. And then I get 12 weeks of training as a profiler. And, of course, other profilers, including the great John Douglas, you know, they had done work on the case before, very good work, and they were darn close in their profiles. But when I got out there, none of that had worked. The investigative stuff hadn't worked because he was leaving no forensic clues. The profile stuff, it was nice to know, a male, between 30 and 50, probably grew up in Chicago. That was all nice to know, but it wasn't solving the case. So I said, what's left here? And on that three-pronged stool that was being offered to us in this particular case, all of a sudden language came in. I was not a linguist back then, but I always had a love for language, playing crossword puzzles, cryptograms, Scrabble, all those type of things on a daily basis. And you notice there's a few scenes of Sam Worthington doing crossword puzzles, because that was me back then too. I actually liked doing that. So I, language meant something to me. I knew we all own the way we speak, the way we write, and there's something more in there than just the words as they're presented. It's also a window into our soul, as I said earlier. And so almost by default, Jim, I said, all right, the other investigators didn't quite get what we need here. The profilers didn't. Let's go to language and see where it takes us. And it wound up opening the cabin door of the Unabomber.
All I have to do is write your name on a box, and I can reach out and touch anyone, anywhere. If a box comes with your name on it, you can't even imagine doing anything other than obey.
The FBI recommendation is that we publish the manifesto.
You know, there's another commonality there. You just said, in explaining about, puzzles and word puzzles between you and Kaczynski. And, you mentioned UTF, which is obviously the Unabomber Task Force. But can you just give some of the broad, beats just around the timescales of this task force operating? Because it was decades, wasn't it? Can you just say something about the first bomb, Kaczynski, was it meld? And just a little bit about the timescale of this investigation.
Well, the earlier bombing, the bombing started in 78 in Chicago. And actually the first mistake, and really the only mistake the Unabomber made, was his very first bombing. And that is, it was supposed to go into a mailbox and be mailed to somebody across the country, but it was too big to fit into the slot. Of course, he never walked into a post office and said, hey, can you put, $5 worth of stamps on this? And so the first bomb was left in a parking lot. A police officer picked it up. It blew up in somebody's office, and luckily nobody was killed. So four bombs in Chicago, and they were the 2 years that Kaczynski lived back in Chicago with his parents and his brother. Then he moved back to the cabin. That's when he started taking buses around the country and mailing and placing bombs. And then he was sighted in 87, putting a bomb down in a parking lot of a computer store. And that's where that iconic composite sketch comes from, of the aviator glasses and the hoodie jacket. Whatever reason, he took off for the next 6 years. No Unabomb activity at all from 87 to 93. And people were speculating. This is before I was involved in the case, but I understood people were speculating that, he was blown up by one of his bombs or lost a hand. Maybe he got a new job. Maybe he was arrested for something else. Sometimes these guys get married and have kids. BTK got married and had kids, and he stopped killing in Wichita, Kansas for a number of years. But then he came back and started again. So next thing you know, 93, the Unabomber comes back with a vengeance, and the writings begin. And next thing you know, in 95, I'm brought in. The UTF is actually formed in 1994. The FBI took over the investigation in the early 80s, and that, of course, is when the acronym itself was created, University Airline Bombings, because they were his first victims, universities and airlines. And in the middle of 94, Director Louis Free wanted to put together this task force, and because all the mailings from 93 were from the San Francisco Bay Area, that's why it was based in the San Francisco division. We all felt, and me included, and we were all wrong about this, but we felt, A, the Unabomber had some connection somehow in his life to the Bay Area. That proved to be correct. And B, we thought maybe he lived within 200 or 300 miles of the Bay Area at this point. That's where we were wrong. But what we found out later is he was traveling 1,500 miles by Greyhound bus from Lincoln, Montana, to mail his packages and mail his bombings off from the Bay Area. But that was his comfort zone, his area of familiarity, and that threw a little bit of that part of the profile off, but eventually it still took us to his cabin in Lincoln.
So, Jim, you mentioned that he took all that time off, and isn't there a serious reason why he came back?
I'm not sure any of us truly know, Jim, why he, you know, why he started bombing again. He certainly would have been free to, you know, live the rest of his life. And without the documents being written, I think it would have been much more difficult to catch him. I know there's been speculation about, you know, other bombings.
Oklahoma City.
Well, that was 95, though. That was spring of 95. And he did have a bombing event that occurred right afterwards, but he swore in one of his letters to the New York Times he had nothing to do with Oklahoma City, and he abhors that kind of random violence. It's funny when one bomber criticizes another bomber for his his modus operandi or his victim selection, something like that. But no, he started bombing again in 93, and all of a sudden something within him said, not only am I going to start bombing again, I'm going to start letting the people know why I'm doing this. And that's when he invented FC, and that he is, you know, anti-technology, and our society has gotten too out of hand with this, you know, advanced big government, big business, big entertainment, and somebody has to put a stop to it, and he felt he was the one.
Mm. So Fitz, the timeline then, the first bomb's 1978, and you then come in 1995, and then he's arrested in 1996. Is that right?
Correct. That is absolutely correct.
And in that time scale, how many did he actually injure and kill?
There were 16 separate bombings, three people killed, about two dozen seriously maimed with fingers and hands blown off, scarred for life. If he had succeeded on his, I believe it was his third or fourth bombing attempt, he put a device and he hooked an altimeter to it, and he sent it through the mail to go, of course, on an airline. And that device did, in fact, detonate, and it filled the cabin area of this American Airlines passenger jet with smoke. And if it wasn't for the valiant efforts of the pilots to conduct an emergency landing, there would have been about 220 people killed then and there. So his numbers, you know, by today's standards are relatively low, but the fact that there could have been 200 added on to that with the airplane crash, as well as he could have kept going on for more and more years. You know, who knows how many more people would have wound up dying, because his devices were getting more deadly and lethal as time went on. And that's very consistent with serial bombers. They get better as they go along. So it's best to catch them early.
Well, they learn too, don't they? And for decades, he kept law enforcement and the public on edge. And, you know, I just think that's a very interesting window. You come in 1995 and 1996 is arrested. So, you know, that is significant.
Yeah, and it's based on your affidavit that he was arrested.
Yeah, you know, the language in his writings is what basically was his downfall. And there's no question about that. And the fact that you know, David Kaczynski recognized the term cool-headed logicians. That was the term that struck him. That was never actually in any of the Kaczynski's, that was never actually in the Kaczynski's personal writings, but there it was in the Unabomber's manifesto. And I remember seeing that term too. Boy, who uses the term cool-headed logician? This is, of course, along with you can't eat your cake and have it too, with the two verbs transposed, and using words like chick and broad to describe women, and Negroes to describe African-Americans, and just some archaic and arcane language, spelling of words, some British spellings he put in there, some alternate spellings, and all these things. I just knew if we could get this out there somehow, published in whatever venue we could, somehow someone will recognize this. And thank God a woman in Paris, France went on the internet for the brand new www.fbi.gov and got in touch with her husband. You should read this thing. I never met your brother, Ted, but I've read the letters he sent you, David, and boy, this sounds like him. So David took a couple of weeks. He read it, and he finally had that light bulb moment. There's another term we won't use on the air, but holy something or other. And he said, my brother just may be the Unabomber. And he wound up pulling out this 23-page document. And this is very accurate in the series. I was, in fact, the real Fitz was back in Quantico. I did my 5 months at the UTF, but then my bosses wanted me back to Quantico because they wanted me to work some serial rape and serial homicide cases. They didn't want to give me up completely to the UTF. So I'm back there about 2.5 months. They faxed me this 23-page document, and I've been faxed about 10 documents before that from different suspects that have come up. And lo and behold, this is the one. This was the Rosetta Stone, as far as I was concerned, to the Unabomber, because there, this 23-page document was an outline in the exact chronological order with the exact same wording, in many cases, exact same sentences that the later manifesto would be. And that's when I called them back and said, guys, you've got your man. And that's when they said, Fitz, you're coming back out.
So in real life, you didn't really throw Keisha, the Whale Rider agent, under the bus, like they depict in the story where she secretly faxes you the pages and all that? And
There have been more tweets about Tabby getting thrown under the bus or getting fired. Nobody really knows. I will tell people to keep watching. I think it'll turn out okay for Tabby. But in real life, she was sort of a composite character. The Natalie character is a composite character. And it wasn't sort of underhanded where I got this 23-page document. It was actually sent to me by the UTF management folks. I looked at it, and a few hours later is when I said, you've got your man, they brought me back out. So, again, a little bit of artistic license. These writers like to do these things, but it does make for a compelling story.
Oh, absolutely. Awesome scene.
Yeah, it makes absolutely no sense, though, right, Fitz? I mean, you're an FBI agent. You have security clearances through the roof. You're an FBI profiler. You're a significant player in the UTF task force. Of course you had access to that letter. Of course they sent it to you. But for Hollywood purposes, it was a great moment. And it sort of paints your character in a very negative way. But hopefully there'll be some rehabilitation. Otherwise, some people are going to end up hating you.
Well, yeah, in the end of the last episode, my then wife doesn't like me. The Natalie linguist character doesn't like me. And Tabby's certainly pretty upset at me. I'm not the biggest likable person as far as UTF management goes, again, by the end of this episode. So I'm kind of out there on my own. So maybe in a way I am a little bit like Ted Kaczynski, at least how the Hollywood writers made it up there. But we actually work together, as I said, pretty well with a team. A lot of composite characters are there's a few composite characters representing a number of other people in the miniseries. And like I said, the time frames and the facts are pretty much right on. It's sort of the interpersonal levels where they're taking some liberties, again, to make it a little more exciting. But again, in my chapter, in my book, it's a long chapter. It ends my book number 3. I really lay it out exactly what happened. And it's still pretty exciting stuff as it is. And Jim, you know, I was talking to you all the time during Unabom. I couldn't tell you everything going on at the time. You were working a big case yourself at the same time in Arkansas, known as Whitewater. Yeah. And we were both going over bits and pieces of what we were doing. And there's just so much interesting stuff here. So the real case is really as exciting as it can be. And I've captured all of that in that long chapter in my book. And the series is doing a little bit of extrapolating to that, but that's okay.
Creatively, but
in the end, I think the FBI comes out looking very good, even if there's some individuals that yell at each other and squabble and upset each other. I think in the long run, it'll show our former agency knew how to get a job done right.
Great. Well, and could you say the name of your book again?
Oh, certainly. It's A Journey to the Center of the Mind. This is book 3, the first 10 FBI years. And as some of your listeners know, I'm writing my memoir in 4 separate books. So this is the third book. And first one's kind of growing up in Philly, having my own experiences with the law, not all of it positive. My second book is my 11 years as a police officer in Bensalem Township. A lot of cool arrests and car chases, gunplay, but a lot of BS politics mixed in the middle. And the third book is my first 10 years in the FBI. And like I said, Jim, you're in there from the first day at the academy on past. So you have a strong supporting role in my book 3.
Well, we did have a lot of interesting experiences, both at the Academy, where we shot our first film together, by the way, and since then, when we were on the NYPD-FBI Joint Bank Robbery Task Force together, and then on the Behavioral Analysis Unit for our closing years in the FBI. Well, for a decade, more than a decade together there. All right, Jim, we'll hopefully get you back on when the show opens in Great Britain and the continent and Australia, and so you can talk to them about it as well, and maybe even when the show is about to wrap up here in the U.S. We'd love to talk to you again.
I'd be glad to do that, Jim. I know you have listeners all over the world, so count me in, and I'll be glad to come back on Real Crime Profile.
Awesome. Great talking to you, Fitz, and to our listeners, thank you for tuning in to Real Crime Profile.
If you like our podcast, there are a few things that you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcast and leave us a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotion and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go over to Facebook and like our Facebook page. And one last thing is please tell all your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening to us. We really appreciate you.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline, free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter or counselling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214-946-4357, or go on their website, www.genesisshelter.org, or the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.